Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by counterterrorism analyst Angie Gadd, and we are taking a look at the events of September the 11th and their legacy on counterterrorism. I hope you find this interesting, and thank you for listening.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Angie, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back on. Just for the benefit of listeners who didn't listen to our previous conversation, which I think was nearly 2 years ago now, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your professional experience?
Sure. I come from a Middle Eastern background. I spent some time growing up when I was, I went to high school and college in Egypt, spent some time in the Middle East, and I got to kind of participate and take part in the revolution in Egypt during the Arab Spring. While that happened, I was still a college student.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a fun time. Sadly, as you know, today, we went back to how it used to be, but that's another podcast. And professionally, I've always studied and been interested in the Middle East, given my background. And I found myself pursuing international relations, poli-sci, Middle Eastern studies in undergrad and in grad school, and started kind of studying intelligence as well in grad school. And I got into counterterrorism. People always ask me, how do you just get into it? But I interned at a government agency, and then I studied intelligence. And then that same agency reached back out a couple of years later, and they were hiring. So I kind of got into the counterterrorism field that way. And I've loved it ever since. I think I've been doing this for about 7 years now. And I kind of focused on the jihadist threat and far-right extremists. I first started off focusing mostly on anti-government militia groups here in the United States, and then that expanded more into kind of white supremacists and neo-Nazis. After that, I spent some time teaching at a couple of universities. I started teaching kind of intelligence, writing and briefing, and homeland security and national security. And then after about a year or so, I switched back into the counterterrorism field, and I'm in the private sector now doing the same thing, but focusing more so on the far right threat instead of jihadists.
Yeah, excellent. We'll come back to that a bit later.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And I say unfortunately, I remember on the day itself,
thinking, not that I was in New York, but I don't know, it felt like World War III was about to kick off. So I kind of feel like 20 years later, I feel kind of pleased that I'm still here. So, and that we all are. But yeah, so it is the 9/11 anniversary. And thank you for joining me on the show today. And I wanted to just ask you some kind of questions about the attacks and its sort of legacy, basically. So I suppose my first question is sort of, how did 9/11 impact you? And do you have any memories of that day?
Yeah, so I might answer the question in reverse. I have very vivid memories. I was about 11 at the time, but I still have very, I think everyone has a very vivid memory of that day. I was in middle school. I was still in the United States. And I remember what happened. I remember they pulled us into a room. They kind of dragged those old TV screens on the carts into the room. And we saw
Yeah.
And they were, they showed us the news and, you know, as an 11-year-old, I don't understand, you know, this is a terrorist attack. I don't think people immediately right off the bat knew that either. And then we got sent home early, went home, and I continued seeing on the news. Nothing really at the time clicked for me. And then I think the next day or a couple days after, we were at recess and a kid asked me, are you Muslim? And I said, yeah. And I was very shocked because I've never talked about religion before. I've never had that kind of conversation. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh, so just like the terrorists. And I was like, what? Nothing clicked. I had no idea what the context was. And I think I went home to my parents and talked to them, and they explained to me kind of why the kid said that. And I think that was when that line had been drawn, and that's where things started to change. And in terms of it impacting me, I want to say, thankfully, I've never been exposed to anything too bad personally, but for my parents and my friends and other people kind of by proxy, I have seen how it's impacted them or how it's impacted my immediate community. I'm not visibly Muslim, so I get a pass. People don't look at me and I don't wear the hijab. People don't kind of see me and think, oh, she's Middle Eastern or she's Muslim. So I kind of slide through a lot and, but it has made a lot of things harder for us and myself included in terms of kind of being a Muslim in America, whether that's praying in public, right? We go out and we're out all day, whether it's in New York or doing something, and we have to pray the five prayers. And a lot of times my friends and my husband will find kind of a secluded area in a park or on the street somewhere and they pray. And until today, I have to do it if there's a mosque, for instance, close by for us to pray in. But a lot of times it's difficult and I find it challenging for myself to do because I still, even 20 years later, I'm like, this is awkward. Even in New York City, which is a very diverse and accepting city for the most part, I find it difficult to pray in public because I know what people are thinking. I know it's alarming. And I'm not someone who kind of is easily scared off but it's still something that, because I think I work in it and I've seen it for so long, I'm hesitant to do stuff like that. I see how people stare at my mom when she used to have the hijab on, my friends who wear the hijab, how even in New York, people see them and they stare, they whisper. I get very defensive. I get very upset when I see these things because it's been 20 years and you would think by now things would have changed, but definitely a lot better than it was 2001, but you still see people are still uncomfortable in our presence. My parents at the time when 9/11 happened, it's crazy. They were undocumented immigrants in the United States. And until the week after 9/11, they got their green card and we got very, very lucky. My dad's friends were getting deported right and left. And thankfully my mom and my dad didn't. We got to stay here. And there was like kind of that fear. They were always afraid of being kind of sent back before 9/11, but it wasn't as urgent or immediate of a concern until 9/11 happened. And we saw within that week kind of everything that that took place.
That's terrible. All of what you've just said there, I mean, it's a terrible experience. I'm sorry that you sort of had to go through that. Do you remember when our last conversation, we spoke a bit about how Islamic extremists have hijacked sort of words and symbols. And when you talk about the praying and stuff, because I remember some of the news footage after 9/11 and suddenly see the sort of terrorist training camps. And it was kind of a combination of men with beards jumping around AK-47s and then moments of like mass praying and things like that. It's sort of like, and I think, you know, Bin Laden, he predicted that the sort of, how's he put it now, sort of the you know, that there'll be a kind of clash of civilizations and the world sort of turn on each other. And it seemed to be that 9/11 sort of kicked up a lot of prejudices that felt like they were going away in the late 90s, because for me the late 90s felt a more positive time, and it felt like the world was starting to, I mean, you know, this is when the end of history was being bouted about as like, oh, this is the new thing, you know. And then obviously that day came and everything sort of changed, those old prejudices came back. So yeah, it's terrible, really. And I don't know where I'm going with that, but but you know what I mean, it's just the whole thing, it's just awful, really. As you were saying earlier about your background, so you studied Islamist extremism and sort of practiced in counterterrorism, focusing on Islamic extremists at the beginning of your career. Can you tell us of some of the things that you learned during your time researching Islamist inspired terrorism?
When I look at kind of my time researching the group specifically, I don't know what I can say that I haven't said before or hasn't been said before about this, but the main point here is that they don't know it's them. The more you read into it, the more you read into their interpretations and their acts, they don't know the religion, and it's just a facade to either seek some kind of personal revenge they have or to overcome some personal experience that they face in their life, and they're taking it out. And that goes for anyone that joins any extremist group or any, whether it's a gang, whether it's a far-right group. I mean, it's very similar across the board. There's kind of these underlying issues at the root of their reasoning, and they find some kind of theological explanation or a clash of civilizations or the great replacement theory for white supremacy. There's always something that will help them justify their actions. At first, I think I thought that it was unique to Islam and unique to jihadists, that they were kind of manipulating the religion. But then as I got older and I kind of studied other extremist groups, I realized that this is very similar with other groups as well. I don't know if that really helps answer the question.
It does. And it actually inspires another one, forgive me. So as you're saying that these terrorist groups or individuals, the religious aspect is a facade. Do ordinary Muslims sort of get that, or are ordinary Muslims just as confused about things as non-Muslims, you know, members of the public who are looking at these sort of extremist groups?
I think for many of the people who are aware and believe that these groups exist and they are not kind of agents of the United States and Israel,
yeah,
yes, they are aware that, you know, when I talk to my father and other people, they're very aware that they're distorting the religion and they're weaponizing it for whatever kind of agendas they have. They don't dig too deep into the weeds when it comes to, like, my father doesn't think too deeply about, okay, like, what led them to this, but they just know that they're weaponizing the religion. And they think of it as not just kind of the jihadists, but also other Muslim figures or preachers in Islam who have misused the religion and misinterpreted things for years that has impacted kind of our community. So yes, they look at people like Al-Qaeda, they look at and Bin Laden and Zawahiri, especially Bin Laden and Zawahiri, and they just think of them as very backwards. They shun kind of any kind of progress or civilization. It's not uncommon from what you and I kind of, how we view these groups and these individuals. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm, that's good. Because one of the things I'm kind of mindful of is, like, from a general public point of view, is a lot of people, like in the UK, every time there's a terrorist attack and it turns out to be ISIS or Al-Qaeda, people just paint this broad brush. And I remember having arguments with relatives and friends about sort of not painting everybody with the same brush. And it's a difficult one, that one, because then I also have met Muslims who, like you were saying a little bit a while back, that believe it was all a great conspiracy and think that actually ISIS or Al-Qaeda are really just secret agents of, you know, of Israel or America, the CIA, and somehow the CIA are all knowing. Even chatting about the situation in Afghanistan and it came up as a topic of, do you think this is all part of the grand plan? You know, so I wonder, I suppose one of my questions is, do you think ordinary Muslims take groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda as a serious threat, or was the conspiratorial view more popular, do you think?
Mostly from my experience, with the exception of the people who have either lived in these regions or have been, or have family members who have been victims of these groups, it's mostly conspiratorial. And I'm not generalizing here. I just want to make sure that you're aware this is from my experience and my engagement with people, whether it's family members, relatives here in the United States or in Egypt and abroad. There is a lot of conspiracy theories that are deep-rooted in the Middle East among certain Arab populations because of the history of distrust with the U.S. government and interventions in the region, whether it's in Iran in the 50s with Mossadegh or whether it's other engagements. They do not trust the United States, and they believe that these groups, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, or 9/11 was an inside attack, and ISIS was a creation of the United States to sow kind of and wreak havoc in the region and kind of destabilize these countries, and an excuse for the United States to kind of come in, intervene, right? The oil, take oil, all that stuff, right? So there's definitely, that is a very prevalent viewpoint and something that's I constantly hear and constantly have to counter, and sometimes it's hard to counter, so you just gotta let it go. But yeah, it's difficult because they will point to some like instances in the past where, oh, the U.S. did, you know, XYZ in the 60s. I'm like, yeah, okay. And then you got to kind of walk them through. And I've had conversations with family members and to kind of debunk the whole 9/11 was an inside job. And yeah, I mean, there's definitely, again, to answer your question, yes, there isn't just like one side. I mean, there's definitely some people who are aware that these groups are real, exist, and have harmed people, especially people who know and have witnessed or have family members have witnessed these or been victims of these attacks. And there's other people who will maybe, for instance, like ISIS attacks in Egypt, for instance, they won't recognize that as ISIS. They'll recognize it as the Muslim Brotherhood so that they can continue, you know, with the regime and what the country has pushed the narrative of the Muslim Brothers, a terrorist organization. That's why we need to ban them and imprison them and et cetera. Whereas it would actually be an ISIS or what was formerly Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, an attack in Sinai, for instance, right? And I'm like, no, those are two very separate groups. And the state in, you know, really kind of blurs that line to make it, to justify kind of their repression of Muslim Brotherhood.
It's becoming increasingly popular today to paint a lot of sort of the post 9/11 counterterrorism policies as racially motivated. Is that fair, or is it more complicated than that?
I think for the most part, it's fair. There's some nuance here, and I'll explain it in a bit. But it is fair to say that a lot of the post 9/11 policies were racially motivated and lacked an understanding of Islam and the various Arab and Muslim communities present in the United States and the West. But I'll speak for the United States, since that's where my experience lays mostly. There have been inquiries into this matter and committees that have investigated this very topic. And the findings revealed that law enforcement engaged in racial profiling post-9/11 that violated the civil rights of Muslims, Arabs, and South Asian communities, immigrants and non-immigrants alike. And our communities, I mean, without kind of even looking at these committees and inquiries, our community already knew that. We lived through it. We saw how our communities were impacted and how they still are today. We'd complain, and our complaints were mostly either not taken seriously or they were sidelined, particularly when it comes or when it came to hate crimes committed against members of our community. Mm. So I don't know what it's like in London, but many people in the United States know that, particularly in the Northeast and in major metropolitan areas in the country, a lot of the cab drivers are South Asian or Arabs or Muslims. And my father was a cabbie for about 10 to 15 years, and him and his friends were subjected to a lot of racism and hate crimes. And there were many more incidents across the country outside of my father and his friends' personal experiences, who sadly were exposed to this. And these incidents still happen today, obviously not at the same kind of volume or frequency as before. There's incidents where undocumented immigrants won't report hate crimes for fear of being deported. And that's very sad. And even before before 9/11, my parents everyone just kind of kept their head down, right? They don't want to raise any attention. And there were others who were legal residents or citizens who don't report incidents because they distrust law enforcement and the government, given how they've seen the government react and target the community post 9/11. And the second part of this, where it, you know, where you say kind of, is it a little bit more complicated than that? It has gotten better, obviously, since 2001. I would say, and this is not a hard number, but like say around 2011 or 2012, there was more rigor introduced in pursuing certain cases and individuals or terrorist attacks. And I'm not saying that racial profiling of Muslims hasn't happened since 2011 or that it stopped altogether, but I joined the counterterrorism community in January of 2015, and I became privy to a lot of how a lot of the anti-Muslim and racially motivated policies were not practiced or tolerated the way they once were in the years after 9/11. There was, even in kind of just looking at the local press briefings for law enforcement, if there was a terrorist attack that was conducted or an attack that was conducted, and the subject or the perpetrator was a brown individual, they wouldn't immediately say, this is a jihadist case or this is a terrorism case. There were a couple incidents that I covered, particularly where law enforcement did not say that right off the bat. And they waited and they investigated me either. They said, no, it was a brown person, but it was not a terrorist case. Or they waited until they were able to find motive and an affiliation to some kind of inspiration to ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And that's where that nuance was. And I don't know if I was just very lucky with the agency I was working with, that we exercised that level of rigor and we didn't jump to any conclusions just because it was someone who was brown or Muslim. But in my sense and my experience with other partner agencies and other law enforcement agencies, that was the practice now. You couldn't just jump and say, hey, just because this person's brown. That doesn't mean that it's not being done, but obviously it's not as acceptable as it was once before, right? And I think that's where that's changed. And yes, immediately post 9/11, that was definitely the case. It wasn't fair and there was a lot of racial profiling, but it's definitely gotten better today. And
yeah,
I hope it continues to get better.
Yeah, well, I suppose one thing that doesn't help matters, so if the police or law enforcement are becoming nuanced, the media don't seem to be as nuanced at times. Mm-hmm. There's still that early reporting of the suspect happens to be of Middle Eastern heritage or appearance. You'll get, you know, all those sort of people on various channels then giving us their opinion on Al-Qaeda and ISIS before we really know what actually happened. And I think that then also seems to lead to the perception that law enforcement think that way too, which I don't always believe to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, because I had a lot of people in my community, for instance, come to me like, oh, well, why is it when the brown guy commits an attack, he's a terrorist, but like when Dylan Roof did the attack in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, why didn't, and I was like, well, I covered that and we have him designated as a terrorist, given his manifesto, given the target, given his affiliations and his interest and all, you know, all the above. And I was like, the media may not classify him as a domestic terrorist, but we do. And that's very spot on with what you just said. It's that what the media does and says is not reflective of what law enforcement is doing. Mm. And when I say law enforcement, I'm talking about a lot of the intel agencies and how they are assessing certain threats. So yeah, that's a very valid point. The media, unfortunately, is always trying to just get that scoop immediately and try to identify the perpetrator, identify everything they know about the background history. And unfortunately, that it's, you know, we've dealt with this a lot, even myself, victim of this, is that it's hard to unlearn that first piece of information you come across. You have to then kind of reteach. And this is how conspiracy theories spread. And this is how people kind of latch on to these original reports that come out from certain media sources.
As you're saying, that early reporting. And the thing is because all these organizations are in competition with each other and they want that exclusive. And like in the UK, like when there's something terrible happens, the BBC is great to start with. And then you kind of shift over to Sky, who are much less, they've got lesser standards, but you kind of get better visuals of what the hell's going on. And then they will declare it as something. And then the BBC will take another half an hour to officially declare it. So I remember when Gaddafi died, so Sky News declared his death at whatever time it was, and it was quite, you know, soon. And then the BBC, it took about an hour, and they had a massive debate about what will happen to Gaddafi. You know, will he go to jail? Will he and you know, while Sky News is saying he was dead. And it's because the BBC, you know, supposedly have higher standards and a higher threshold before they say it is an established fact. But, you know, no, it was quite interesting, that sort of differing coverage. And that happens quite often, actually.
That's actually, I didn't know that about the BBC. Mm. That's a good parallel to draw between how intel agencies operate versus the media in the United States. Mm. Because whereas the media can go out and say, oh, blah, 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 XYZ happened, they can go back and be like, oh, by the way, here's a correction. We messed up. But if an intel agency or an intel shop continuously makes these mistakes, we lose our credibility as analysts. It's hard to gain for like every, if you make one mistake, you need about 10 or 15 more exposures with that policymaker, decision maker to get them to trust you again. It sounds like, I guess, intel shops in the United States operate a little bit like the BBC then, since they apply a little bit more rigor before claiming that something is, which I very much respect that approach.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And I think, you know, as we were saying about conspiracy theories and stuff, I think too many news organizations have taken liberties with the truth to get an exclusive. And now it's led to that, because I hate to criticize the media, because now I feel like I'm becoming a conspiracy theorist, where you say the mainstream media with quotation marks, you know. Oh, you don't believe the BBC, do you? You know, it's that kind of thing. But from what I've seen, I know people who work for many news organizations, and you know, it's definitely that, you know, there isn't a red telephone that rings up when something's happening, ordering people how to report stuff. It's just you know, some news organizations are just ruthless. Go out and get whatever you can, you know, because we want coverage, you know. There's even a classic song from the 80s about the news and dirty laundry. Who the hell's that song, Bob? Definitely the media don't help matters with these things. We've sort of touched upon this, but what are Muslims that you've spoken with and you know, feel about the kind of the US government response to Al Qaeda and ISIS? You know, what are their sort of feelings of being about that?
It's, you're right. So it kind of goes back to, right, the conspiracy theories, and it goes back to distrust of the US government and them using, right? So the narrative goes 9/11 was an inside job so that the United States couldn't invade. Mostly, kind of from my background, they focus mostly on the invasion of Iraq versus Afghanistan. So they use that to invade Iraq so that they can destabilize the region. And I'm telling you this, I kind of have this whole conspiracy theory memorized. It was like, they're going to invade Iraq, and then after that, they're going to invade Syria, and then they're going to invade Iran. And it's crazy because once this Arab uprisings happened in 2011, you started to see some countries become more destabilized and crumble. And that's what we saw with Syria. So my dad was like, oh my God, you see? Syria was, I told you Syria, like 10 years ago, I told you Syria was after, like, whatever. Like, it was kind of like that, like, oh, the conspiracy theories are like materializing, and this is all to assist Israel in destabilizing its neighboring country so that Israel could be the main power and that we can bring down some, like, so that's essentially how they view the government's response to the threat. And that's, again, not everyone. Mostly it's kind of the older kind of immigrant, my immigrant parents or immigrants or people in the United, people living in the region who are just tired of US intervention.
Yeah.
And they think, okay, well, they invaded Iraq for their oil. They wanted to get rid of Saddam. And they use 9/11 as an excuse. And that's basically, I mean, that's basically, and a lot of conspiracy theories come from this main parent conspiracy theory. And then the ISIS one is basically like, oh, like the United States was already in Iraq, and then they created ISIS to further destabilize Syria, because Syria was the only, and this is according to conspiracy theory, but Syria was the only kind of country, one of the only countries that after Saddam was like standing up to Israel. So they wanted to get rid of them too. And now Syria is kind of a destabilized country, and America's kind of getting its way in the region. It was essentially how it's viewed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've heard those theories too. I used to I used to do a late night directing class 10 years ago, in fact. And one of my classmates was a Turkish lady, and, you know, as we got to know each other. It's always when you get to know someone, suddenly they think, okay, you know, I'm going to sit down with Chris and, you know, do you know you're being lied to and stuff? And like,
all right.
And it was this sort of, yeah, again, it was exactly the plan that you've just described. But she was coming at it from a kind of weird, kind of slight communist bent. Because I think, so she was a bit older than me. And her family were very sympathetic to communism in Turkey and stuff like that. And there seemed to be, so there was definitely a communist element to this. And I can't remember what it was now. But I've definitely heard all these things. And this idea about actually, it's all about greater Israel or something. And Israel's going to expand to the point where it'll become the entire Middle East or something. And what's the other one I've heard? Oh, it's loads. But and it's all about oil and, you know.
Yeah.
What was your... Sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, this is... I haven't heard the communist twist, so I'm very like, that's very intriguing. There's so many different variations and the main one is usually the same. But yeah, it's just it's been 20 years of this and it's very exhausting to continuously have to engage in these conversations.
And my observation of Middle Eastern culture, and forgive the generalization, but for many different people I spoke to from different regions, conspiracy theories do seem to be very popular in Middle Eastern culture. And it's not just American or Israeli ones. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories for all sorts of things, you know. And maybe, and I've tried to wonder why that is, and I think you were talking about it earlier. I suppose because there are such repressive regimes in many Middle Eastern countries where, you know, like, for example, some of my relatives from Iraq and so they have all sorts of stories about, you know, sons being whisked off at night by the secret police, never to be seen again. And then the mother goes to the police station. She goes three times. And on the third time, the secret police tell her to never come back. Otherwise, you know, you're gone. So it might probably that. And also, you know, so many, I don't know, it's been so much political change in the Middle East through its history. I guess it just breeds that kind of mindset, really, that nothing can be taken for granted. I don't know. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, I've thought about it. You raised some really good points I've never considered, and I have no idea why it's such a breeding ground for conspiracy theories and why a lot of people in the region are so susceptible to it. It's something to read into that I've never thought. It's just I've been around it my whole life, and I don't know what the origins of it are or why we're more susceptible to it, but social media does not help
No. And I think also in the Middle East, the Cold War didn't help either, because certainly I know Russia weaponized certain conspiracy theories, as they do now, to help, you know, their geopolitical plans in the Middle East and make it difficult for American geopolitical plans in the Middle East. And definitely that's where I think the kind of the slight communist bent of that comes from. And I wish I could remember what those theories were now, but but there we go. Well, with some of those things in mind, I mean, what has been the response to your career in counterterrorism from friends and associates within the Muslim community?
So, yeah, this one has been pretty mixed. And the response has been one of two things. Either, oh, my God, that's great. That's super badass. That's a really cool gig that you have. Tell me more. And that's usually a pleasant surprise. But it does happen more frequently now than it used to before. The other response, which is obviously not as pleasant, is that... I'm kind of, betraying my community. How could I work with the same government that is committing all these atrocities, not just in terms of violating civil rights of Muslims here in the United States, but attacking our home countries, the collateral damage, the innocent victims of certain U.S. strikes? How could you possibly be supportive of this? And be a proud Muslim. And I think this has been something that I've struggled with a lot. It's been something that has cut some pretty deep wounds over the years. And I always now, as much as I'm proud of what I do and as much as I love my job and what I focus on, and I know how much, as little recognition as we get as analysts, because we operate in, you know, our names are put out there. We aren't internally, yes, but, you know, publicly, not really. And a lot of times I can't kind of tout my successes to my friends. As much as I'm proud of what I do, I've come to the point now where when someone asks me, what do? I get very uncomfortable. And I'm a very open, very transparent person. I share everything. I love to share. And so it's funny because when my husband and I are out there, like, oh, like, what do you guys do? And I'm like, oh God. And I'm like, I let him answer first because I am just like building myself up to answer. But surprisingly, I've noticed it's gotten It hasn't gotten it. It's not as bad as it used to be, but I still face a lot of like pushback and people kind of really just like, oh, I'm not okay with this. I think your moral compass is off here. And this is where I kind of kick into high gear and I start defending myself and defending what I do and explaining that they're like, oh, like, so you are behind, you're the reason that Muslims are being killed overseas. And I'm like, I'm not a targeting analyst. I'm also, you know, and it gets into this whole long discussion about it. And eventually I either convince people that I'm doing a good deed and I'm trying to possibly represent our community and our religion within the counterterrorism field to correct a lot of the wrongs and to provide nuance where there previously wasn't. Because there's so much distrust between the Muslim community and the government, because of how the government responded post 9/11, that is why you see a lot of people either react the way they do when they find out what I do, or they obviously don't condone these kind of jobs, or they don't pursue these kind of jobs. I remember when I was in the government, I worked on something where it was like, you know, why aren't we getting more young Muslim professionals kind of joining the field? And I was like, well, that's because XYZ. And I think the former CIA director at one point in 2009 went to speak in Michigan, which has a heavy Muslim population, to kind of address this topic. Yeah. And I was not received well. And I think it was Liam Panetta. And the issue was that, you know, you built so much distrust, and you're not going to have these people at your disposal that you can leverage kind of our language skills, our background, our understanding and nuance of the religion and the communities to assist in countering the threat. So sadly, it's been a mixed reaction, and I've just had to navigate it. And it's usually positive, and there's highs, and a lot of times there's lows, but you just deal with it. It comes with the territory.
I've always sort of seen, in a sense, what you and others do is quite a noble profession, because the way I view Islamic extremist groups, maybe I'm naive or wrong in this, but they seem to thrive off chaos and thrive off, you know, alienating Muslims from the governments of the countries they're in. And obviously, US government and British government policy doesn't necessarily help that. You know, if Afghanistan and Iraq hadn't happened after 9/11, had America taken a different approach, and there wasn't so much sort of blood on the hands of US foreign policy, which is, and I'll put foreign policy in its own little place, because counterterrorism policy and foreign policy are separate things, but people obviously may think it's all one amalgamated thing. So, you know, if 9/11 and the response to it and the foreign policy response to it being different, I wonder, and it's, you know, it's difficult to speculate, but I wonder if Muslims might feel differently about what you do today, because you seem to be tackling people who are trying to make the religion a bad thing, you know?
I wonder the same. And I honestly think the issues that the Muslim community and Arabs and South Asians faced in the United States post 9/11, I think the broader issue was how the U.S. responded to 9/11 in these other countries and how it led to another intervention. Those military interventions are, in my opinion, that's how Anwar al-Awlaki was radicalized, right? I mean, he was a regular preacher and very charismatic, still was after becoming an al-Qaeda member. It was the U.S. invasion that really kind of, that was his, the moment where he was like, this isn't okay. These innocent people dying are okay. And I think that's what it is, because that's what happens with friends of mine overseas, where the issue isn't, oh, like, how are Muslims mistreated in the United States? I don't really think about that. They think about how the U.S. has handled itself internationally. Mm. And I agree. I think if it had been handled differently, maybe it would have been very different in terms of how people respond when they found out what I do for a living. But that's kind of like a different reality that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app.
Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This has got a big question. Do you think the threat of Islamist-inspired terrorism was overblown post 9/11, or at least the reaction to that threat?
Yeah, I think that's a better way of putting it, the reaction to the threat. Mm. Yeah, I think in the sense that all Muslims and Muslim communities in the West became the target of mass surveillance and racial profiling over the acts of a handful of fringe extremists, absolutely it was overblown. Again, I feel like a broken record, but I think more rigor should have been applied to understanding Islam, Muslims, and the very, very small percentage and subset of Muslims that are radical or extremist to better scope and limit our response post 9/11. I think we just talked about this, but the military interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq inevitably led to so much collateral damage, lots of innocent people dying, thousands, not millions. I have been displaced internally, and there's been tons of refugees, and a lot of people have become victims of U.S. counterterrorism strikes that, in essence, again, not to sound cliche, but have created more enemies for the United States than it has deterred.
Yeah.
And our reaction post 9/11 was emotional, and rightfully so. The attacks on 9/11 were not something that it was extremely tragic, and the amount of people that died was horrific. And I just don't think our response was measured or leveled enough in hindsight when you look at it, because it caused more problems, not only for us in how we deal with this threat, it caused more problems for the citizens of the countries that we invaded. And that, unfortunately, it's a cycle where it ended up impacting us again, right? So it's unfortunate. Yeah. So I do think that our reaction to the threat was definitely overblown. And it's hard to say that. And I know 9/11 is not something easy to talk about and say, hey, we overreacted, because it wasn't. It is a big deal. But kind of in hindsight and looking 20 years later and looking at everything that's happened since, even with the withdrawal, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, it's a lot of people are questioning, did we do the right thing? Did we withdraw properly? Should we have stayed? Should we have been there for that long?
There are answers to all those questions, aren't there? Right. You know, there's a yes to all of those and a no to all of those. Right. That's the one thing I've found, especially talking to people.
Right.
Yeah, it's difficult. But I think the one thing the withdrawal maybe has potentially exposed is, and this is me saying it's not you, but it's sort of like the impression I get is that the military on the ground really didn't understand Afghanistan at all. And I think that 20 years later, and that was the result of 20 years of being in Afghanistan, and then, you know, the government collapses and the army run away, which is being maybe a little bit unfair to some of the army, but I don't kind of half blame them. If I had to, you know, if the Taliban were coming on my door, I think I'd run away too. But, you know, I just think, you know, I was talking to Frank Snepp, who's a former CIA officer who was in Vietnam and stuff, and he his experiences in Vietnam, the army were, I don't know if necessarily lying, but they were sort of falsifying or giving a false impression of progress. And I think that may be what Afghanistan's exposed, that, you know, it's happened again. Less progress being made than people thought, you know, and it's tragic, because now you do have... So we're going off a tangent, but you do have a kind of generation of people who've kind of grown up in a slightly different Afghanistan. There's a little, not hugely westernized, but a little bit. There's a few more freedoms than there were before, and it's all been just taken away from them. And I just find that horrific. I really do.
It's very sad.
Just one last, because I feel like, we've sort of really gone full on the Islamist side, but one last Islamist question, I suppose. Do you think Islamist-inspired terrorism is as great a threat to the United States and the West today as it was perceived 20 years ago?
In terms of the facts on the ground, I do not think that the threat from jihadists is as great of a threat to the United States as it was 20 years ago. We've increased our counterterrorism measures and capabilities in the United States and other Western countries. The intent versus the capability of a lot of these extremists and jihadist groups, right? The benchmark has always been, we want to do another 9/11, and they haven't been able to. The closest they've gotten was the November 2015 Paris attacks. But in terms of actually conducting large-scale coordinated attacks from the core groups, not inspired actors who conduct kind of smaller attacks, I don't think they possess those capabilities currently. The landscape has changed, right? The movement is today, compared to 20 years ago, is far more decentralized, and it's more focused on local issues and conflicts and capitalizing on local grievances, local trying to take over local resources. And that has been a result of expansion of these groups and them relying on their affiliates. A lot of it has also come down to infighting between the two major jihadist models and groups, right? ISIS and Al-Qaeda. There's been a lot of tension there, and that's led to them fighting each other on the ground in certain areas in Africa and the Middle East, and in Asia, Southeast Asia. And the threat now is mostly focused, or is mostly concentrated, in Africa and Afghanistan. And I think the threat for us here in the United States is most of the coming from the far right extremists, and the threat is domestic. I definitely don't think jihadists have the same capabilities they did back then. And even back then, I don't think they could have conducted another 9/11.
Yeah. As far as I've seen, I think 9/11 was a very bold move. It was the embassy bombings, then it was the USS Cole, and then it was 9/11, the Black Banners by Ali Soufan, I'm basing this on. But, that was like the defining moment for Al-Qaeda. It was because they weren't being taken seriously, and then that happened.
Right.
And then, it became the kind of dominant franchise for that, for that kind of terrorism, yeah. Really.
And they haven't been able to really meet that level of success ever since, with kind of like an aging leadership, old guard. The death of Bin Laden and al-Awlaki, who were both very charismatic leaders. You have a aging population now of these, especially with Al-Qaeda. We don't even know if Zawahiri's, right? Everyone's saying he's dead. And he wasn't as charismatic, right? So it's an issue with leadership. Yes, these groups are made to withstand leadership losses, right? But they lack leaders like Bin Laden, Zawahiri, and even Baghdadi, who kind of energized the movement and made people want to kind of join and conduct attacks on their behalf. And you just don't, it's just a different generation now of leaders, and the movement's just shifted so much and changed over the past 20 years.
You mentioned that you're now seeing the rise of the far right as one of the greater threats to the United States these days. And also, we've talked in the past about this sort of idea of a clash of civilizations, which I think is sort of given oxygen to the far right in the last 20 years, which they didn't have before, and also the connectivity with social media and so on. Can you talk just a little bit about sort of what you've learned about these sort of far right groups, what the situation is today, and just generally what your thoughts are on this rising threat?
So it's interesting because, especially after kind of the January 6th Capitol raid happened, a lot of people are like, what is this emergent threat? And it's definitely not emergent. It's been around for a while, and it just hasn't been taken seriously. People haven't focused on it as much because there was obviously the big shiny object was jihadists and Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So we really very much neglected the domestic threat from far right, and they've just been able to operate and continue to grow and gain momentum here in the United States because they've been, for the most part, left to kind of their own devices. I mean, not entirely, but for the most part, they've had much more freedom and flexibility to maneuver. And when you kind of talk about the clash of civilizations narrative, it's funny because I always draw a parallel. Once I tied that parallel, started drawing a parallel between the far right and jihadists. And the clash of civilizations narrative is just one component of that. It's funny, they agree with jihadists that there is this clash of civilizations, that everyone kind of needs to separate and live in their own, whether it's kind of in their own caliphate or in a white ethnostate. They agree with jihadists that, they reject liberal Western ideals, they reject feminism and LGBTQ rights and all that stuff. It's very similar, even with the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, right? I've seen a lot of members within far-right communities, far-right extremist communities, applauding what Taliban did and celebrating it and expressing their desire to have their own territory for white people and to kick out foreign influences like Taliban did with the U.S. forces. So, I've written about this in the past. Many in the far-right admire and share tactics that are used by jihadists, whether that's the apocalyptic element that ISIS was so good at kind of coining. You have neo-Nazi accelerationist groups that want to accelerate the collapse of society to rebuild a white ethnicity in its place. This has been going on for so long, and it's crazy how sometimes my two worlds come together and I see a far-right extremist sharing an Al-Qaeda manual, and I'm like, what's going on here? And the threat is, it's getting more attention now in the media. It's getting a lot more coverage, but it's definitely been around. You can go back to Timothy McVeigh. You can go back all the way to the 1800s with the KKK. It's been around for a very long time. I think once it started impacting and leading to the raid on a U.S. Capitol building in the middle of an election, that's when it started to become more real. And people kind of started to focus on the far right. Not that there have been agencies, government agencies have been focusing on the far right for many years before January 6th, 2021.
Yeah. Question, actually, back to our media point earlier. Like, yeah. Again, the media seem very reluctant to label clearly terrorist incidents, and the perpetrators have to be white, and they seem to be hesitant to use the terrorist label, and they tend to find other labels. Would you say that's the same with law enforcement, or is it a bit like what we were saying earlier about how law enforcement are in one place and the media is somewhere completely different?
From my experience, yes, internally and in any intel shop, in the intel shops I've worked at, yes, we label them internally as terrorists. Mm. If they check off all the boxes and they meet their requirements, they are terrorists. But unfortunately, the media doesn't approach it the same way. And it's sad because this is where a lot of the conspiracy theories form among the Middle Eastern community, Muslim Middle Eastern communities, is that how come we're getting labeled as such, but a white guy does X, Y, Z, and they're not labeled as such. And that's where a lot of that comes. And I see this argument come up all the time and time again. And again, I just make the argument that I classify them, we classify them as domestic terrorists. I mean, people like Dylann Roof, anyone who's committed an attack to further political or social agenda, and they have a manifesto and they have a specific motive, that checks off the box like it would for someone who's jihadist. So yeah, sadly, the media is not a representation or reflection of how certain law enforcement government agencies classify these threats. So
yeah, but at least the perception, doesn't it, that they do.
Right. And that doesn't help the case at all, I know.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. Well, have there been any sort of positive developments in counterterrorism that give you or can give us any hope in the sort of threats or responses to the threats that we're facing today?
I mean, not to kind of beat this with a dead horse, but having started working far in 2015, along with ISIS, I have seen so much more progress in covering and taking that threat more seriously and having people come and ask us and actually spend the time, hey, I need you to look into threats from the far right, where as before we'd be inundated with what is the threat from jihadists. I mean, I rarely get, as in my experience, as an analyst, I get asked more about the far right than I do about jihadists, which is showing how people are realizing, hey, this is a threat. This isn't positive, but counterterrorism policy, unfortunately, is more reactive than it is proactive. And I would love for it to be more proactive in kind of looking at these threats where it was like, hey, we've been warning about these guys. We warned about January 6th in December or before it ever happened. And we knew there was something that was going to go down. And it's just, unfortunately, we get inundated with these requests and calls after the fact. And I just wish it was.
Yeah. Well, and sadly, that's never changed, is it? Because even no. The pre-9/11 world suffered from that, didn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. I think this issue being reactive versus proactive is not just exclusive to counterterrorism, by the way. I think this is a bigger, a broader issue, whether it's natural disasters or anything, right? We always kind of try to fix it after the fact.
So. Yeah, I think, I don't know, it's an interesting one because there's so many things that happen that feel like they're really obvious, but a lot of people just don't see it. And then it does happen, right. And then we have a debate about it, and then we do something about it. And it's an interesting one. And I certainly, and I don't think it's exclusive to government bureaucracies, this mindset, but I think certainly government bureaucracies do suffer from it in the sense of, you know, I guess because people, their careers are on the line. If you're the one who suggests we've got to divert 50 million into,
right.
I don't know, the Italian separatist threat, and it turns out that they don't even exist, you know?
Right. It's on you. It's your head. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I can understand some of that caution, but yeah, no, right. it's it's a complex question that, I suppose. but how to fix that. But is there anything else you'd like to add before we sort of wrap up today?
I think, especially in this day and age, with how divided we've become, whether it's just the United States or globally, I mean, I've seen this divide kind of taking place more on an international level as well. a lot of us are just guilty, myself included, of falling victim to tribalism, groupthink, bias, sticking to our clan, overreacting to situations that we haven't been faced with before, unprecedented events like COVID. And it's just led to, I don't know if this is just in my time, this is the first time it's happened in my lifetime, yeah. But I've never kind of faced a situation where people in society have been this divided, and I don't know what the solution is, but I think it's just to have compassion for and empathy for your fellow human on earth. It's, I know this sounds super cliche and very naive, but it's just the amount of stuff I see on a daily basis and the amount of hate and visceral reaction and the conspiracy theories. It's so hard to, I mean, I just wish we could just pull out of that for a little bit and, I don't know, just learn to have more love and compassion for one another. It's just, I think my world is just so full of hate and terrorism all day that I'm kind of like, I wish we could just love each other a little bit more, but it's, I understand that it's just a subset of what kind of society is going through. And I'm unfortunately just exposed to a lot of the negative chatter all day.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, thank you for the work that you do. So, you know, of course. It can't be easy. So, yeah. But on one final note, I suppose this, somebody once said, and I know I've said it before, but it wasn't me who coined this, but, you know, it's our humanity that got us into this, and it'll be our humanity that will get us out of it.
That's a much better way of saying what I just said.
I'm sure it's from Star Trek. I think it might be from Star Trek, but
that's exactly what I wanted to say.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. Where can, if you want to be connected with, where can listeners connect with you?
I'm on Twitter. It's Angie's List, and List is spelled with a Y. So it's AngieSlyst.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time, and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.